Hello and welcome to episode 13 of Let Them Eat Cake. This episode we speak to Scott Richards, someone who has been deeply involved with Afghanistan for close to a decade, spending time in country and advising government officials with a body of anti-corruption work to boot. Scott has a unique view inside the country as it collapsed, and we discuss this and the terrorism/crime nexus that has spilled out of Afghanistan and the surrounding countries. As always, we are Fifth Gen, an information warfare cooperative that aims to shed light on things those in power want to be kept in the dark. We want to give a voice to the voiceless and give people the information they need to thrive in a world that tries so hard to starve you of it. Today, we're changing it up. The show will be hosted by John and Ace. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoy the show.
We have a weapon more powerful than the British Empire, and that weapon is our refusal to bow to any order but our own, any institution but our own.
So I'm Scott Richards. I spent about 8 years working with Afghanistan. Originally went in there in 2014. As a special advisor to the Minister of Finance, and then later appended to the Attorney General's office. Spent a lot of time working on anti-corruption, was a particular core focus, and developed a lot of relationships over that time. And as it sort of went on, I ended up becoming involved in aspects of the Doha process as one of my associates was related to the Khalilzad family. And when the collapse of the Republic happened, I had a very unique and front row seat to what went on with the Taliban, and at the same time was providing advisory support to the UK's Minister Siobhan Bailey, who was in charge of the Afghan task force. So I have a lot of different experience, and I spent a lot of time working in Africa and other areas, particularly related to jihadism and also to political affairs and economic development.
What is the greatest threat out there for us right now?
The greatest threat out there for us right now is where we see the intersection of poverty, jihadism, and climate. And I've been thinking about this a lot lately in that, you know, when we look at Africa, when we look at the presence of ISIS, and we look at the connectedness of jihadism these days, and you couple that with severe droughts, you couple that with corruption, we're creating a perfect storm. You know, where it becomes almost rational, I think, for people who are in a poverty state, in a desperation state, to look at these options. And I think we're going to see a massive explosion. We're really at a precipice right now, and one that I think we'll find very difficult to come back from.
And Africa is the youngest population in the world. Most young people come into age right now. So Africa has all the potential to be great.
Africa has always had tremendous potential to be great. You know, obviously with its resource base, the post-colonialism, the structures of power that have come into place there with sort of lifelong presidents, and also what I would call strategic corruption, which the West has certainly benefited from. You know, but we're seeing, catastrophic droughts. You have, I think, 250 million people in the Sahel region, which is one of the most vulnerable areas for climate change. But then on that same region, you've got, you know, the weapons movements and the trafficking movements that come through Libya and go down into Nigeria. And then you've got, you know, another belt of jihadism really taking root across East Africa. And this vision of jihadism is always about the caliphate. And Afghanistan has the advantage of being the potential seat of that, which I think is really Osama bin Laden's original vision all the way back. And that's kind of we're in a very, very dangerous place. I don't think we appreciate that, you know, the West has been tremendously unsuccessful, largely in counterterrorism. You know, if you look at our successes, they are few and far between, if at all, particularly since the onset of the war on terror. You know, marginal successes back in the 90s. But, you know, our approach, you know, whether that's Somalia, with AFRICOM kind of being the hot topic at the moment, it's unlikely to do anything to turn the situation around, because we're not looking at the root causes of why people are attracted. And as you say, you know, when you have a population under 25, that is always an indicator that you're going to face a risk of organized violence. And I tend to prefer the term organized violence, you know, in a number of cases, because you know, it can be many things. It can be, you know, a political movement. It can be terrorism. It can be other things. It's a little bit broader.
Scott, this is may come off as a bit of a broad and kind of like not great question, but when I look at like areas like sub-Saharan Africa and the Sahel, mm-hmm. and like the sheer size of these countries and some of the areas that like insurgents operate in, if you could like explain almost like I'm five, like how do these groups organize with one another? How does like, for example, like ISIS in the Sahel organize with their partners in neighboring countries, if at all?
And then there's a whole Al-Qaeda coalition now down there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's like, it really, cause it's like, I don't think people realize like on a map, they don't look that big. Mm-hmm. Like, they're massive. These are huge, like Burkina Faso, Niger.
And no infrastructure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No infrastructure, very little electricity. Like, it's not like there's satellite towers everywhere. So it's like, it almost seems like a daft question to ask, but I really wonder, like, how do these groups organize with one another?
And I think I'll start probably with the first part of what Al-Qaeda really brought to the game, because that helps understand how things like ISIS and these things franchise. And people just find this a bit strange, but Al-Qaeda created kind of a terrorist franchise model. You know, they have an Al-Qaeda manual, which basically is a blueprint for how to set up a cell and operate, how to raise money, how to do a kidnapping, and all these other kinds of aspects. So they created the ability to franchise, which enabled them to sort of take off and expand very, very quickly. And ISIS then kind of took that to the next level, at least in Syria, with the sophistication of their communications and their marketing and their Telegram channels. When you get into Africa, you'll find that trade and criminality has a lot to do with it. ADF in DRC and Uganda, they're inherently connected to Al-Shabaab. Mm-hmm. And you'll find that the connectivity happens there with things like diesel smuggling, smuggled mm-hmm. fuel, exchange TTPs by sending people to different locations, mm-hmm. Different skill sets and different sorts of capabilities. I mean, we saw this in Nigeria with the UN bombing in Abuja. Before that point, Boko Haram was generally limited to kind of a small package-style bomb attacks. Mm-hmm. And then overnight, they went to a VBIED.
Since you mentioned the ADF, I actually wanted to ask you, because like this is something that always comes up when you're talking about a group that operates in the DRC. Mm-hmm. Do blood diamonds have anything to do with it or no?
Gold.
Gold?
Gold more than diamonds in DRC. What you'll always find with terrorists or with any threat organization is they will sell whatever there is around them. You know, mm-hmm. in Mali, you'll find them trading in wildlife trafficking, you know, for elephant tusks and other things like that. ISIS were doing that. They killed a number of the rare elephants there. You'll see a lot of gold come out of DRC and moved into Kenya, Tanzania, or Uganda. Uganda doesn't actually produce gold, but it has seven borders. So you'll find a lot of the traffic comes in there, and then it'll have to go to Tanzania to be ported out, or it'll be papered up and sold.
Yeah, we look at Uganda a lot with human trafficking.
Uganda is a country that we've been sort of quietly working with for a number of years now, and we're just sort of kind of waiting to take that into some kind of more detailed steps. But human trafficking was something that we looked at a lot there, wildlife trafficking, and we were due to go in there, but then COVID hit on those topics. And then we've kind of been circled more into the threat of ADF and Al-Shabaab and other terrorist organizations that are becoming a lot stronger and a lot more mobile. You know, and it depends, you know, when you look at the connectivity, I mean, Boko Haram was the ones doing a lot of human trafficking out of Nigeria into Libya, you know, that whole chain. So you get the human trafficking going up and you get the narcotics and the weapons coming down. Out of Libya.
Back in my day, because we were talking about how they like specialize and train and things. So they say that he was the founder of ISIS. It's not true, but Zarqawi, the dude was an idiot, but they trained him in chemical weapons, right? Mm-hmm. And after Fallujah, there was a shitload of chlorine attacks that just mm-hmm. kept going off. So we started controlling chlorine. Cholera outbroke, mm-hmm. killed more people. So he was sent there to make chemical weapons because that's what mm-hmm. the U.S. was there to find.
One of the things that people don't understand is just how connected jihadism is, at least on the AQIP side, the ISIS side, when you talk about Syria, and the Afghan side. And, you know, kind of one of the things I always like to you know, because we tend to think of these things as different things, and we tend to look at things in the West in isolation. And colleagues of mine, you know, literally jumped into West Cairo after the assassination of Anwar Sadat, and then went on to work in, you know, two special mission units over the next 20 years. But when you kind of go back to Afghanistan, you know, with Zawahiri and bin Laden in 80 and Peshawar, and then the assassination of Sadat happens, that's really the crucible where it really changes. Because you get, you know, a number of those figures that are in prison, Zawahiri being one of them and several others, after they get out, they go back to Afghanistan. And they go back to Afghanistan extremely radicalized. And then you see, you know, Ramadan Abedi, his father, he was LIFG in Afghanistan. So the LIFG crowd ties back in there. Obviously, the Haqqanis are in there.
That's what I was going to get to next.
Yeah, and they're intermarried. But the Haqqanis were a very, very different entity in the sense that, from at least my work, we would see them continuously in connexes, connecting threat networks in Afghanistan. So you'd come across them, you know, whether it's money laundering or weapons or drugs, you'd find them with D Company, which is Dawood Ibrahim out of India. You'd find them with IRGC. You'd find them with Al-Qaeda. They were always able to be an interlocutor between terrorist networks, and obviously with the Taliban as well. And obviously, you know, the relationships, you know, during that 20-year war that the Haqqanis had with the ISI, you know, present always in major attacks, present always. And they have that same kind of emissary liaison approach with ISIS. The earliest that we know of them having a serious relationship with ISIS in Syria is around about 2014. And it was a particular individual who is known as the Quiet General in Kabul today. But so there's 8 years of relationship, you know, with the Syrian side. So that's part of the, I guess, the challenge when we talk about ISIS in Afghanistan. Everyone says, oh, ISIS KP. And it's like, that's not what we're talking about anymore.
I just want to say, we have extensive videos on the assassination of Anwar Sadat, the rise of Al-Qaeda, some stuff on the Haqqani network on there. We have a lot of stuff on our channel to get more into detail about some of the things that he was just talking about.
Mr. President, the organization Human Rights Watch says that there are 60,000 political prisoners that you're holding today as we sit here.
I don't know where they got that figure. I said there are no political prisoners in Egypt. Whenever there is a minority trying to impose their extremist ideology, we have to intervene regardless of their numbers.
I'm glad you brought up the assassination of Anwar Sadat, because it's like your average Joe in Egypt is kind of aware of this. It's kind of like a political cliche to say the biggest creator of terrorists in the world are the Egyptian prison systems. Prison is a nightmare. You can't see the sun. You're not even sleeping on a mattress. You're not allowed to have books. You're not allowed to get letters from family members. If any person was placed in those conditions, they would become radicalized. Like, it's perfect. Mm-hmm. And the only people in there with you is the guy in the next, like, wall-thin cell who you can kind of yell at before a guard comes by and beats the shit out of you. It's almost like, you know, how the prison system in the U.S. and other countries just produces career criminals, really.
Yeah, there's absolutely no reform in the West. And, you know, if you go into prison in the West, you will find a struggle to reintegrate. You know, not always, but you're absolutely right. You know, those Egyptian prisons became the crucible, and then the prison recruiting became almost a methodology. You see the same thing, you know, in Iraq with the Baghdadi comes out of the prison system when there's that mass release, and then we've got prisoners in, you know, Bagram that get radicalized. Guantanamo did do us any favors.
What I was going to ask, kind of a dickish question. Who do you think's worse, the U.S. prisons or everyone else's prisons?
I mean, Guantanamo is, you know, it's a horrible thing. And, you know, I think that we lost...
Especially when they first started it and people were, like, shitting into pipes. Like, just regular open pipes outside in cages like dogs.
We don't do any favors with things like Guantanamo Bay because we lose the high moral ground. We break our own international laws that we claim to be, you know, espousing and supporting. And when you lose the high moral ground, we lose a lot of the argument against radicalism. And I think that, you know, to go back to the climate change thing, you know, when you look at who is causing the damage, it's the West. It's the way that we produce, the way that we manufacture, And so if you're in Africa and you're watching 4 years of drought, and somebody comes along and says, you know, your kids are going to die of starvation and whatever else, and you know who did this to you? The West. That's not an unconvincing argument. We're not making things better, and we didn't make things better, you know, with our conduct, with things like Gitmo, and those guys, when they were released, just went back to jihad, largely. You know, you had
Gitmo detaining. I know a few people who were in there who are, you know.
Wow.
You know, because there's a few ones who are, like Cage. I know some mm-hmm. of the guys that work at Cage, and then there's a few people who wrote books and things like that. So, as a journalist, yeah, you interview people for pressers and stuff.
Wow, I mean that would be, you know, incredible to hear those perspectives. I've never spoken directly with anybody that went through those experiences, but it, you know, the inhumanity of it is awful, and it's unjustifiable, and you know, we should never have done it. Torture is an ineffective means of eliciting information. It just doesn't work. So we have a lot of responsibility in how we got here as well.
Really, that's what the genius of 9/11 really was, because he had the ability to break the U.S. like that.
Mm-hmm. I would 100% agree with that. You know, OBL's original plan to drag America into a war that would send it broke, to use Afghanistan as the base for a new caliphate. And his third objective was to unite the Muslim world against the West by seeing Muslim blood spilled in Afghanistan. It was number three that he didn't really succeed on, but he succeeded in one and two. It may have taken 20 years, but, you know, the Talibs and Al-Qaeda control Afghanistan. He did it.
Was it a mistake to withdraw?
Yes, unequivocally. But it was a mistake that was long in the making with the atrocity that was Doha. And
Orange Man bad?
Hmm?
Is Orange Man bad?
Orange Man bad. Orange Man's a comp... he was... How can I put Orange this? He had... he wasn't wrong about some things, the foreign policy. He was absolutely wrong about approach to Doha, and I really put it down to that Obama got a Nobel Peace Prize, and that I guess he figured if he could bring peace, you know, the Abraham Accords and Afghanistan, that they couldn't deny him one. I think it was really motivated by that, and I don't even joke that.
Oh yeah, I mean it's Trump we're talking about here. Like, yeah, just psychology.
It's just very ego-driven.
Ironically, you know, the peace prize that Obama got is now causing a genocide. So,
yeah,
this is going to be bad. What did he get it for again?
He got it for settling the conflict between Ethiopia and Eritrea. Now Ethiopia and Eritrea are committing a genocide in Tigray.
Oh fuck, dude.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were a little fast out of the gate with that one.
How do you give Arafwaki a fucking Nobel Peace Prize? Like, it's like
the Nobel Peace Prize isn't looking, track record isn't looking good, right? Like Aung San Suu Kyi. Oh shit.
Yeah, that's another one too.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of international bodies that we have that are meant to stand up for a lot more. But to go back to the mistake, so you know what you really see in that final year of, you know, when Biden comes in and decides to stick with the deal, is that we really don't have a plan for what withdrawal looks like. And we're really betting on this idea of Taliban 2.0. And, I mean, I can say from my experiences, as I was brought in to that process at times, and this is how I know a lot of the Taliban quite well. So I was brought in, the first point I was brought in is when the Taliban felt that they were not doing very well in the media, and that they were not given space and they didn't know how to communicate. So I got pulled in for strategy on that by the US, out of the Khalilzad team. So you have partly me to blame for that, because it was like, this is going to break down, this is going to break down. And I'm like, okay. And so when you talk to them at that point, they seemed really reasonable.
Yeah, honestly, that's the impression that I get whenever I fuck with them. They don't seem like somebody who would strap you to a car bomb and just because you talk nasty about them. They don't seem like those kind of guys.
But they do. And so, you know, he's passed away now under what I would call suspicious circumstances. So I'll give you a little bit more background. I've talked about a lot of this openly on Twitter so that nobody could kind of come at me and say, well, you did this in the Doha Agreement and you know these guys and you did that. So my chief of party, and the Taliban published this, was Zalmay Khalilzad's brother-in-law. And he joined as a senior advisor to Khalil and Siraj. And so, you know, when the Republic went down, that's kind of when I got brought back in for a lot of stuff. Because I had withdrawn from, you know, really any assistance to Doha because of what I saw going on. It was kind of when Biden came in, and it's not to do with Biden in that regard, but I knew that it was wrong, and it wasn't going, and they weren't being honest with where this is headed, because I became aware of, like I mentioned, they brought in, you know, people with relationships to Al-Qaeda. It was not, you know, at that point, it's like, okay, this isn't what this is about. They're supposed to break relationships with these people, but they brought them in at the table. But so when August 15th happened, and I had warned Congress in a paper that in July 25th, that the fall of Kabul was coming and how it would come. It was kind of a very weird moment because it's like, okay, I knew the position of the central bank. I knew the monetary collapse that was coming in. And so I have messages from the Haqqanis asking, you know, how do we get off sanctions? How do we do this? How do we do that? And they're like, okay, even in those messages, they're like, you know, we want to stop narcotics, we want to rebuild the economy. It's like 12 things that the West would want to hear. I was like, okay. So I think August 22nd, we wrote the custodian banking strategy. Originally, we're looking at Qatar for that, the one that Biden's now talking about using Switzerland. And we helped the Taliban draft a document for the United Nations to talk about getting humanitarian aid in. And that's when I started to see it really go wrong. And it was after September 7th, when the ISI chief came in. And so we get back the document. It turns into a hostage negotiation. And it's like, wow, okay. You're just making demands. But, you know, they derailed so fast in September, blindingly quick. And that's when you had the fragmentation with Mullah Baradar and everything else like that. So all that hope that we had was undone just way too fast. It was never really solid. And I think it was always kind of the plan to hijack, you know, the peace process and to hijack it and put these people in place. Because I would say, you know, if you don't want to be sanctioned, don't appoint 18 out of 30 something, you know, ministers who are all on a sanctions list. You know, you've created a sanctioned government. You could have chosen anyone else to be in that power, but because of your selfishness and looking at war as a reward that you feel you've won the country, you know, you've pushed the nation into starvation. You've pushed the nation, you've broken the economy. And this is a choice that the Taliban made. So yes, Doha was a mistake. We shouldn't have drawn the way we did. We haven't made anything better. We've made Afghanistan a country where we're essentially blind. We pulled out all our intelligence apparatus. And we have no idea of what's going on across most of the country. We have no idea who's in there.
They said that they knew Zarqawi was there for 6 months.
Yeah, I knew he was there in November. I reported that in November last year.
Oh, yeah? I think it was Bilal Shamwi. He said that somebody reported that like 4 different known EIJ guys fled after. So he probably had like the Shura Council or Praetorian Guard there too with him. Right?
Yeah. There are another couple of bodies in there that we don't know who it is. And, you know, fairly credible rumors of senior Haqqani in there as well.
Was this one of those situations where the minute the U.S. pulled out, he was just in Afghanistan?
So the first kind of movements that we knew of, you know, one of OBL's sons was in there October. First I heard of him there was in November. Came up through Pakistan into Afghanistan and then went north and came down into Kabul and then went north again. Because what I keep saying, there's been a lot of activity in the north that's been ignored a lot.
It kind of reminds me like a little detail I noticed. in like this, it's like a frontline documentary by PBS, and this journalist, forget his name, he's Afghan though. He's going to meet with like these ISKP quote unquote guys, and he's in like the far northern reaches of the country when he meets with them. So that I found that like just like that little detail pretty interesting when I watched that. So
yeah, I mean, we've been smacking our head against the wall for a long time on that one, and it's just started to get some traction. So we first knew about what was going on up in Kunduz around November, December. And so you would have these, a lot of meetings would take place between the Haqqanis and ISIS, you know, in Kunduz. And they would meet at the airport. And the other place they'd go to is Imam Sahib, which was run by a guy who, like, that we have his war name is Idris, Abu Idris. And he's, you know, come out of Syria and Iraq.
Now Massoud is reaching out to the United States to help end the crisis.
The West has two concerns. First, terrorist bases, and second, narcotics.
Instability in Afghanistan is in the interests of those who promote Islamic revolution.
Afghanistan may well be in the headlines for all the wrong reasons in the 90s if some of these issues aren't addressed.
One of the things we like to pretend in the West is that we didn't know this was happening. We didn't know what was going on. I mean, 2019, when we saw the targeted assassinations happening, you know, 700 of them, the types of targets. Now, analysis was, this is precursor to takeover, right? This is societal attack, and this is getting ready for where Doha went, for a full Taliban takeover. This was all coming. Yeah, Afghanistan could find itself in a civil war, and it won't be a civil war that comes from, you know, Massoud and the NRF. It'll be a civil war that comes from the breakup of relations inside jihadism. And we're getting to that point.
Would you say that that would be not a good thing for Afghanistan, but a good thing for the West? If they're fighting each other, they're not fighting us, right? Isn't that the theory? I mean, that's what we did with the cartel, and that worked out great, didn't it?
Yeah. But, you know, that's also a very British strategy as well, turn them against each other. But that doesn't tend to work for very long, because someone will win and it will consolidate again.
Would I be wrong to say that, I guess you could say, jihadist groups in Afghanistan kind of have a very good ability to, like, collect themselves against a common enemy, even if they hate each other?
Yeah, so there's a few things that come to this. And again, some of the things that I think I probably tweeted at, and people said I was insane. Back in May, maybe, I said that the TTP and friends in Afghanistan are looking to Balochistan next to try to make an IEA-style government. Lo and behold, a couple of days ago, it gets announced that TTP activities in Balochistan. The reason that we know these things is that there's a lot of terrorist meetings, and they had one in May, you know, with AQ, with ISIS, with TTP, on Balochistan. And then they had another one in Torkham on something else. So they have these powwows with the players. So the challenge for the Haqqanis is that they have a deep relationship with Pakistan. And so for them, the TTP is a problem. For them, jihadism in Pakistan is a problem. But Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and large numbers of the Taliban have no issues. But the commitment of all these organizations is to caliphate, particularly ISIS. So what happens when Zawahiri gets killed is that there's a lot of paranoia about how they found him and who gave up the location inside the jihadist movement, or whether the agency just lucked out and found them. But that death results in Al-Qaeda and ISIS not trusting the Haqqanis so much anymore. And the death of Zawahiri really brought away the last obstacle between Al-Qaeda and ISIS becoming friends again. That changed everything.
Would it have been better to leave him alive then?
Probably.
Oof.
Probably. It's trophy kill.
He was very old.
He was very old.
He's very old.
No, same with Bin Laden. We knew where he was. Pretending we didn't is not real.
Yeah, I've seen like three different theories, but like, you know, there's like Seymour Hersh. I mean, he's pretty credible, and he straight up said that somebody came in and they said Pakistani intelligence knew, like, right there, and they had it a while ago.
His family were in contact, Abiel's family the whole time, and they were never inaccessible. As it seems to recall, Obama was having a spat with the agency at the time, and then magically we find Bin Laden, you know, and everything's great again. But we didn't win anything from that. Zawahiri was really a trophy kill, and a try to bookend this idea of the war on terror. We're taking out the new Al-Qaeda leader.
Yeah, it's over. We completed the war on terror. It's done.
Yeah, you haven't done anything. I mean, Al-Qaeda... The other mistake we make is we think about Al-Qaeda as being box cutters and hijacking and whatever else. But, you know, Al-Qaeda these days, in their own communications, will say that we are not the Al-Qaeda of 20 years ago. We are an Al-Qaeda that understands encryption. We're an Al-Qaeda that understands a whole lot more. We're not fighting guys hiding in caves anymore. They've learned over 20 years fighting us. You know, I would say the Haqqanis, you know, the sophistication that they show politically, they're incredibly good at telling the West what we want to hear while doing the complete opposite. You know, they say, you know, amnesty. That never existed. You know, I spoke to the Taliban on that one. You know, we'd call them and I'd say, well, what's happening with the amnesty? And then they were like, the amnesty is bullshit. And so they're saying, amnesty, amnesty, amnesty. And then they're saying, oh, no, it's rogue elements of the Taliban. It's like, no, it's not. You know, we know who's running these squads, hunting these guys and doing the night raids. For a year and a half, they've dragged us on. And they've been so sophisticated with it politically. They know how to pull our heartstrings and not deliver anything.
Yeah, they're smart.
Wickedly smart. And then there's all, you know, they had a lot of think tanks coaching them. And, you know, as I said, for a period, I helped them on media strategy because I was under the impression that Taliban 2.0, and if it didn't happen, that they didn't get what they wanted, that the violence would break that back down again. They were going to pull out of the talks. So it's like, okay, keep them in the talks. That was, you know, that wasn't my mistake. I have to own these things. But I think we understand problems in our intelligence approach to intelligence, because these are countries that are driven by relationships. And so what we tend to do is we send 25-year-olds down there for 6 months. We have no reputation after we just upped and left. There's so many NDS guys still on the ground hiding, and they, you know, they're terrified. So they won't trust us again. Who would?
Yeah.
How do we build source networks?
That's what everyone was saying when we fucked over the Kurds, is who's going to trust us again?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And all we do is open the doors for other actors.
Yeah, and that's what I tell people is, it's like, if you don't support these groups, Al-Qaeda will.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. People talk about, you know, ISIS and whatever else. They were running around in September last year. They were in straight away, offering food, money, and revenge was their pitch.
Yeah, and I've heard that they can pay more than the Taliban.
They always have.
This is beginning to sound like the whole conversation around Syria like 10 years ago.
Oh, yeah. That's what we said.
Oh my God. Every time Syria gets brought up, if I'm just sitting with friends, I cannot explain how badly that was handled. Definitely there was always these flashes of almost, not really Al-Qaeda style Islamism, but more Muslim Brotherhood style Islamism. Mm-hmm. That could like work within a, I guess, quote unquote, like a liberal democratic framework.
Mm-hmm.
But like the minute Aleppo happened, I guess everything kind of went down the shitter, for lack of a better term.
What we need to also look at is that America is a democratic country. And in large part, Americans are not interested in violence overseas. We're not interested
no,
in our own
no,
military industrial complex. I would really like to see Europe really start stepping the game up, because it's not going to, like, the American people are just, eventually, it's going to stop. We're going to pull out of Afghanistan because we've had it after 20 years.
The thing is, no offense to my fellow Americans, but I feel like the vast majority of Americans can't really differentiate between, like, a foreign policy decision and, like, all-out war. Mm-hmm. Like, when the no-fly zone over Ukraine was discussed, mm-hmm. people were acting like we were going to get dragged into, like, World War III.
You know, disinformation is a powerful tool, but it's become used so haphazardly and just conveniently and not strategically. It's just been used for pure division. And it's very effective against the West.
Mm-hmm.
We could circle back into something that you mentioned about the proposition that we put in. And also that comes out of a thing called the Regional Friendship Agreement, Friendship Cooperation Agreement. And so this is kind of, do you mind if I smoke?
No, yeah, go for it. We don't.
Go for it.
add the casual atmosphere of things. So obviously you have the ISIS threat, the TTT, and you have this various nonsense that the Taliban will come out and say, like, oh, we won't let anybody use, you know, our land to attack other countries. And it's like, well, There's a T for Tajikistan in TTT. There's a P for Pakistan in TTP, and they're on your ground.
They're firing rockets into other countries right
yeah,
now.
It's happening.
Denounce Al-Qaeda. I think one of the issues is the concern of sort of the network and terrorist organizations.
دا اجازه موږ چاته نه ورکو دا زموږ خپل حکومت دی موږ نه غواړو چې بل چا په امور کې مداخله وکړو.
This is how I think counterterrorism should be done. And in a kind of, as I said, I've been lucky enough to have been mentored by 20-year combat deployed tier one guys who were in all the big events. You know, for 14-15 years I've been working with those guys who were retired out. And so, you know, we used to talk a lot about soft power and hard power. And you know, the other wing of what I do is economic activation and economic development. So we've turned around, like, you know, the worst parts of an economy. You can. We did it in 3 years. We did the lowest resident satisfaction, the highest. So I got a request from a country that basically said, you know, how do we deal with ISIS? And so it was like June 20th I got that. So June 30th I put in a paper about regional cooperation, that really the Central Asian states can be a buffer against the spread of jihad, you know, and these belief systems north, which eventually, if they do go that direction, would link up with Chechnya and everything else, then we risk, you know, a contagion event of instability. You know, instability is like a failed state, it's like a black hole that draws other countries into its collapse. And so that framework became the Regional Friendship Cooperation Agreement. Which was ratified on the 22nd, I think, of July, which is the fastest I've ever seen a government do anything. Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, and Uzbekistan signed, and Tajik and Turkmenistan pledged to, once they get through, some legal consideration. Because the only way that you can deal with these threats is in a coordinated manner. And you have to deal with prosperity. You have to deal with economic uplift. And so while there's poverty, or what I call kind of, to use a hacking term, attack surface area. And you have to remove attack surface areas that are exploitable by threat organizations to proliferate. Something that kind of comes off the back of that is that these countries know that, you know, as we go deeper into winter, that people aren't going to go to Pakistan. Some of them are going to try to go across Iran, and a lot of them are probably pushing the Central Asian borders. And so what are they going to do with millions of refugees? And so I, you know, I had this conversation with some of these governments, and I think in October we put together, you know, a proposition. Basically, the problem with Afghanistan is that as a failed state, it's basically like Somaliland, with no constitution. It's unrecognized. And in its unrecognized manner, you can't get in. UNHCR, all these other things, can't go into the country. And then the Taliban will divert aid. So you have this situation where the only agency that can operate is the WFP. Not necessarily, you know, able to get everywhere, and there's a lot of criticism about food quality and not really the diversity in food. So people depend on things like a seal and other stuff. So the only way to deal with the situation, I think 50-something% of people don't have enough winter clothes, there's not enough wood, not enough coal, is you stage humanitarian aid of the border countries of Afghanistan inside those countries. Those countries have the other advantage that Kyrgyzstan, for example, border state, supplies food to Afghanistan. The Taliban appreciated that. Turkmenistan supplies electricity.
Yeah, I was about to say, their whole electricity grid is like provided from someone else.
So the Taliban can't misbehave with them in the same way they can with, ironically, the United Nations or whoever else, the WFP or so on and so forth. And then you basically get the United Nations and Red Cross and everybody else to buy goods from within the Central Asian economies, because they've got some surpluses of food that they don't know what to do with. So now they buy the apples that they've got too many of in some of these countries. Now we create economic stimulation, and aid is not just a burden. We're also not flying in as much food and crap and everything else. And then people can start making clothes in Uzbekistan to provide the Afghans, and then you get the money being spent in the local economy. So you get a double effect. Kyrgyzstan presented that paper at the Moscow conference as part of their statement, and so we're waiting to see where it goes. And working kind of very, very hard on it. It has gone across to various elements of UNAMA and other aspects of the UN. But I can't see any other way to do it.
But do you think there's other places where basically the same method could be applied?
Yeah, I think we need to look at crisis staging and crisis coordination. And that's something that we're working on. So I don't know if you guys have followed any of the stuff that we've done in Ukraine. We were doing a lot of evacuation and food delivery in Afghanistan. And then when Ukraine sort of started, we went straight in there. And so we've like delivered like 70,000 liters of water to cancer hospitals, evac, you know, 600 orphans, disabled kids, and been providing food and medical all the way in the front lines. And so the kind of the most notable thing about it is that when Dylan Healey and Paul Yuri were captured by the Russian separatist forces, those families came to us to do the prison release. But so what we see in Afghanistan, what we see in Ukraine is a lot of people trying to coordinate across Signal. And that's great. I'm fully supportive of this and have done amazing things on Signal with people. And, you know, we've arranged surgeries and rescues and you name it. But crisis coordination is sorely missing. Because at some point you have to connect with the larger bodies of the aid agencies and you have to connect with local government. You don't want to just be freewheeling out there throwing bags of food to people. Better crisis coordination, and that comes into staging. And I think, at least on the UN side of would this work for other countries, hell yeah, we should be buying locally. You start to bring some money into the economy. You know, we talk about all these ideas of resilience. People don't know what that means. They throw it out there in development all the time. But we talk about these things, and they're just not done. And there's no reason why we can't do them, other than vested interest in contracts and corruption.
You can offer them career opportunities to be coordinators, especially in Africa with all the young folks. But if the climate goes to shit and everyone has to leave anyway, you're not really going
to
help.
No, and we need to really look at how we deal with that. Just the nature of the work that we do is we're able to have very blunt conversations with very senior political people. Literally will tell all the way up to presidents that you had 10 years. Two of those years are gone. And then we're going to see more and more production become domestic because of robotics and AI. When robotics and AI merge, the cost of production in the West will go virtually down to zero. And it's going to hit farming. So your cheap labor is not any use to anyone anymore. We're going to get better at resource efficiency, and we're going to get better at recycling rare earth metals from phones and other things that we have. You're going to have really nothing to trade. We're going to increase productivity with vertical farming. We have robots that can pick more apples or strawberries than human beings, and the cost of the robots will come down. So you have to adapt now. And they're listening. This is the first time I'm having, you know, governments come back and say, all right, we need to look at this, and we need to look at this regionally. And that's part of what the Regional Cooperation, Friendship Cooperation Agreement is about. So you have to come back down to regional and say, right, we need to take our future in our own hands. And we need to be smart about it. We need to be smart about attracting private capital. We need to be smart. And we're doing this knowing that this helps our security and stability. And so they're kind of having these conversations in Uganda, Kenya, Tanzania at the moment, because those are the three states that we could probably, that coordinated amongst themselves, removing issues with border trade and everything else, that could have economic uplift, which will insulate them from the terror threat. But it's not something that's a USAID type project. They're just not capable of thinking in this manner.
I think it was Uganda specifically, they did an aid program. They gave them that food that they didn't want. Like they gave them like all corn or potatoes, and they're like, we don't eat this.
This is not our diet. But you see that all the time, and that's, I should qualify. When I worked in Afghanistan, I never worked for RS. In fact, they didn't like me very much. I worked for the Afghan government, for Jarawa, in Jarawa's interests. And so, you know, you would see these programs, and even the early NATO stuff in 2007, it's like, we will have all militants disarmed by 2008, and all girls in school by 2009. And it's like, dude, have any of you guys who wrote this been there? This is not a plan. And so you get these plans hatched outside of the country, hatched by people that just have never left Wazir Akbar Khan, if they've been in at all. So the other problem that you have to, that people need to understand is that all of the money went into Kabul. And the only other locations that ever really got any activity was Herat and Mazar-i-Sharif. And so Herat had the Italian presence and Mazar had the German presence. We would go to the EU compound in Kabul. Had a really, really, really lovely kind of garden area with some peacocks roaming around. And you talk to the EU guys, and they'd be like, "See that wall there? That's a it's another embassy across the road, and it's like a laneway that's maybe as far as I can stretch my arms." And they like, they have to get in full body armor to go across that. There's no mobility, and so I was also part of a thing called Oversight Coordination Body, which was the interface for the donor countries to the Afghan government to fund the country. And so you'd ask about, you know, favorite words of development committee, monitoring and evaluation. And you'd be like, "Okay, so what have you guys done on this road project out there?" I was like, "Oh, well, you know, it's too dangerous." And
the road project's my favorite.
Yeah.
How much money did that cost?
Billions of nothing. And that's the thing when you go out there and you say, "Oh, we spent $2.8 trillion on Iraq and Afghanistan." And you know, you go into Afghanistan, you can't see no trillion dollars. All you did was put the money into contracts for beltway companies, and that money's all in D.C. You know, or you had a couple of Afghans that became very wealthy, being contracting partners, and they bought villas in the Palm in Dubai. But, you know, so we didn't have any real presence to build for schools and things like that. I mean, the Taliban blew a lot of them up. You know, so it's why when the Talibs talk about education being important, it's like, you guys were blowing up hundreds of schools. But so, yeah, we didn't really have any penetration of development into other provinces. And when we talk about things like justice programs, I remember when I did the first 100 days of Farid Hamidi, His Excellency the Attorney General, right when he came in. I was one of the first people he met when he came to Kabul. And so he just got appointed, and I went into the AG's offices. And they didn't have any computers. And they had these little kerosene-burning things they were cooking their lunch on their desks. So I kind of wander around. I'm like, "Okay, so I hear about, you know, JSSP and all these justice programs. I'm in the office, and there are no computers." And I, you know, shouted at a lot of people in the embassy. And then the Chinese offered to give the AG computers. I'm like, "Okay, RS, do you really want to have the Chinese backdooring the entire justice sector? Because that's what's going to happen." And then they finally got computers. But we would go and say, "Okay, well, we need prosecutors to be trained for Farah or Nimroz or somewhere else," because we'd carefully built a justice sector in these vulnerable Taliban areas. And like, "Okay, we need support. You know, we can get this area, you know, functioning." And because justice is a huge issue. It's why a lot of people in Somalia will say the same thing. You know, these jihadists may not be good people, but the justice is equitable.
With the justice system in Afghanistan was so bad that was the main thing I would hear from people, is they would go to the Taliban because you would get justice now.
Yep, they'll ride on a motorcycle, someone stole your goats, I'll listen to those people talk and then they'll shoot one of them.
The football stadium is a place of leisure, a place for playing games, a place for joy. When justice is done on behalf of a victim, that too is a joyful event.
The international community paid for a football stadium. They wanted the Afghan people to play football there.
They help us to build a separate place suitable for carrying out executions. We have no problem with that.
You're familiar with the Anti-Corruption Justice Center?
I mean, a little, but...
Because basically, 2015, I'm with the Ministry of Finance and we're talking about the problems, and we wrote a presentation for a financial crimes and civil commercial court. The Ministry of Finance is like, "This is absolutely what we need." And so we go to RS to sort of drum up support. We've got the Supreme Court's behind it, everybody's behind it, High Economic Council signs it off. So I was in a meeting with RS and the commanders there and the EF3s, everybody's there. And this guy we'd briefed literally decides, he gives my presentation, basically. So this major goes, "We've decided to create the Anti-Corruption Justice Center." And I'm just, "No." And I warned and I warned and I warned. I said, they are going to use this as a political court to take out enemies in Kabul. The Afghans will do it. The U.S. will do it. It will make everything more unstable. Do not do it. Sitting at a table, I put my head down, and Ministry of Finance's guy goes, now Scott will give the Ministry of Finance's presentation. And I'm like, I got nothing. And I just like mouth open, and I just had to kind of just make up a speech about the failure of the West to reach communities in the country because they stole it in front of me. So they threw out an actual functioning court concept to bring in ACJC. And rather than have a civil court that could enforce contracts.
Everyone says that the Taliban is good at combating corruption. What do you think about that?
Absolutely not. Look at passports, right? The cost on passports should be about $150, maybe less. You're going to pay $2,000 upwards. Look at visas and look at narcotics. They are thumping out narcotics. They are making a fortune from illicit weapons trafficking. They're making a fortune from corruption. That's all they know. They don't know how to run a government. The idea that they're not corrupt, they're worse.
Could you imagine like guys from the Taliban who try to sit down and write up a city with like water infrastructure? There's got to be at least one like civil engineer in the Taliban. There's got to be at least one.
It got worse. I remember it very, very distinctly because obviously throughout August, I had conversations through my guy to the Talibs, because like I said, we knew what was coming. We knew what was coming with the financial problems. We knew what was coming with the funds being withheld. We knew what was coming with winter. And so for that first month, you could have some pretty constructive conversations with some of them. Talked about the concept of like, what if we made a digital Afghani? Because we do that very, very quickly, very easily. And basically, use a crypto as a representative of dollars held in, private deposits and commercial deposits that are held in New York or wherever. Parts of dabs under the Talib at that point were like, okay, this is interesting. This is interesting. Some of the older guys didn't get it. But once September 7 hit, I remember it's because it was my birthday as well. When my guy rings up, he's like, Scott, I've decided to join the Taliban. You should join with me. This is my chief of party, right? I've got pictures of him having dinner in a house that I've eaten at countless times with all the Haqqanis. And I say, I can't do that. And he goes, wherever I go, you go. At that point, we were able to have constructive conversations for about a week until the kind of Haqqani takeover really took. And then the mullahocracy comes in. They start throwing out people who are actually maybe capable. And so you see the replacement of people potentially with knowledge, or people that were in Doha that may have been more constructive, replaced with just mullahs. And religious education becomes the only education that's needed. On the Friday before they invaded Pangaea, I said, so what are you guys doing with Pangaea? And they're like, oh, Pangaea, it's finished. And I'm like, well, dude, if you think it's bad now, wait until you guys are all war criminals.
I heard a lot of stuff going on, but...
Yeah, so we were the guys that did the first reports to the United Nations in October, November, and did the parliamentary...
The thing is that also at this time, reporters were also posting Arma 3 again. Like, somebody got them with that footage again for the third time.
Oh, yeah.
So it's as far
Holy
as reports
shit.
Coming out of there when they were doing the Pangaea shit, I didn't know what to make.
I mean, those guys would go up on the side because they've got jammers in there. The Pakistanis went in there. They were inserting via helicopter and supporting, and they did use the CH-4 drone, which they tried to kill. I think they were Solrum.
Everyone told me the drones didn't happen. So
No. The CH-4 drone happened. I'm the one who reported it, and I saw the blast site. And so the guys would go off on the sides of mountains to get out of the jam array and call my team, feed across intel. And so we got witness statements, recordings, everything else. I was on the phone when it was all happening. And it's the same with the fight with Barada. I was on the phone when that shit was happening. To a point I said, yeah, we could deal with them. I remember one time they kidnapped, we got a minister out, deputy minister out, and the Talibs wanted this guy back. So they kidnapped his father. And I could ring them at that time. And I rang them up like, hey, dude. I would call them dude, literally. I said, you took one of mine. And it's like, oh, no, we didn't. I said, yeah, you did. And they're like, no, we don't. And I said, well, here's the house he's staying at, with the geopin two doors down from the Iranian embassy. I said, do you mind not? I got him back 2 days later. You could have these kind of frank, almost funny conversations with them. Before Pangaea kicked off. But Pangaea was the end of really my interaction. Yeah, it was just over. And so I drafted the original exile and exile government strategy for the NRF. I think Lynn O'Donnell covered it in Foreign Policy.
They hate Lynn O'Donnell over there.
Yeah, they do.
Well, they like arrested her and like made her tweet an apology or something.
Lynn's a friend of mine. So I remember when that happened, you know, because I got a message that Lynn's out of contact. She really tries to dig into stories in a lot of ways some journalists don't. But making her an enemy was a really bad idea on their part.
Short-sighted.
Incredibly. And that's the way that they are. Reactionary, not capable of long-term planning. They're just not pragmatic.
This is not Afghanistan's problem. The consumers are engaging in complete hypocrisy. The West is not doing its bit to cut down consumption. The West must either have the courage to legalize use of drugs or to enforce its security apparatus. We need to turn the searchlight on how is it that tons of heroin are making their way to the West, despite billions and tens of billions of dollars of expenditure on security. There must be breach. So they need to start strengthening their own security, or they need to come to terms.
As Ghani points out, opium does have valid medicinal uses, and the crop could become part of the legitimate economy.
For some sections of Afghanistan, we must explore legal cultivation. India is growing it legally. France is growing it legally. Australia is growing it.
Ace, you want to get anything in?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that these people have absolutely no issue with dealing narcotics, like ISIS or Al-Qaeda. There's no problem at all. It's in their literature.
Yep.
Like, that's the other thing people don't realize. It's like, if you need to raise money, mm-hmm. like, sure, it's not, like, great religiously, but you're in a corner, bro. Like, go sell some drugs.
Yeah, go crimes, go kidnap people. This is actually a really important thing. We call it a crime nexus. We were looking at drug and addiction in the Indian Ocean. And so what we would see is that ships would transship narcotics in the Indian Ocean. And so I started looking at drug routes. And so you look at all the DEA maps and like, oh, the drugs go from, you know, down from Afghanistan through Pakistan and into East Africa. And then they drive it across to Nigeria. And I'm like, that just doesn't corroborate with any captures. And then you look into it and it's like 90% of Afghanistan's heroin goes across the Iranian border. And a much better route, because then you're straight into Turkey. Counter-narcotics was just a lie about how these drugs are moving. This is a really important nexus. Hezbollah runs a lot of the drugs into Europe.
And
then you've got Hezbollah linking up with Nandreta and ISIS.
And like you've also got Hezbollah. They wash all the drug money in the Ivory Coast. I didn't know this till I was much older, but we used to have Gambian family friends. Mm-hmm. And when I was younger, I just thought they were Sunni like us. But my parents told me later on, like, no, they're Shia. There's like a really small, mm-hmm. like Shia kind of almost elite population in West Africa, where it's like really a lot of Sunnis. But these Shias, they're very prominent. And so Hezbollah goes in there. And basically what they do is they just wash the money and open, like, in these guys' like used car businesses, furniture. Oh. The money is gone. The money is gone, dude. There's no trace. You gonna send a DEA agent to the Ivory Coast to investigate their used car industry? Bro, that car is in the hands of some like 16-year-old cab driver. It's mm-hmm. gone. Like
Yeah, I mean, now that you're raised, I've looked through a lot of reports on Hezbollah and money laundering, and I've seen the used cars a lot. But when we talk about that crime nexus, so Nandreta is the largest money laundering operation in the world for crime, but they also move all the pills into Libya, what we call the jihadist candy, you know, the uppers, or the codeine.
The Captagon.
Yeah, the Captagon and the amphetamine.
Yep.
And they move vast quantities of it. So ISIS and Nandreta are connected, and Hezbollah and Nandreta are connected. So now you have these nexuses. When you can move drugs, you can move guns, you can move bombs, you can move people. It's an infrastructure. And so that terrorist crime nexus gives, organized crime gives threat actors another logistics channel.
Who are the state actors that you would say support this?
Syria.
Yeah.
Syria's one. Syria's the obvious one.
Yep, Syria, Iran, obviously you've got issues in Lebanon on this. Turkey obviously has done a lot with ISIS into Libya. I think on the Western side, It's again our inability to deal with it. I mean, Andretta command and control is in Canada, in Toronto. You know, we see so much. Canada is just diabolically full of money laundering and an IRGC and everything. But we just don't address this stuff.
There's another thing is, like, I feel like people forget when they're talking about Iran is Iran has a huge, like, criminal like underworld. They have like like almost their own like cartels out there. I wouldn't say they're Mexican cartel tier, but they're close.
Hezbollah, IRGC are obviously connected, and you've got Hezbollah all through Latin America, and we did see certain behavioral changes take place, you know, in the cartels, you know, that indicate, you know, relationship.
Yeah, I know for a fact that we have seen Wagner and IRGC working with cartels.
I think the whole way the DEA was originally alert to Hezbollah like drug trafficking was they intercepted a phone call. Yeah, I mean it also all that shit goes back to the Caribbean as well, because there's a Lebanese community in the Caribbean.
Yep.
And a lot of them are prominent business people.
Yep. I mean, you look at the potential, you know, for people smuggling, you could bring in bad guys and terrorists easily piggybacking through the cartel. I mean, we know a lot of bad guys, known Haqqanis and everything else, made it into the U.S. in those initial evac flights. We know. We know they did. We don't know what they want to do, but we know they're there. It's just, yeah, I mean, it's such a disaster right now. And in the multipolar world, the coordination will get worse, the proliferation will get bigger. You know, and it's very, very, very scary right now.
So to wrap up here, I wanted to talk about the media, because they're always fear-mongering. You know, it's always the invasion of Taiwan is going to end the world. Qasem Soleimani is going to start World War III with bombing him.
Basically, do you think Polish farms will start World War III? Do you think that's going to happen?
Everyone's focused on these conflicts. Do you think that their attention really needs to be directed towards what we've been talking about? And how do you think that should be approached? Like, how do you even get through to the media that they're going to destroy the world?
I think we don't understand the Ukraine war in the first place, and Ukraine war isn't the primary objective of Russia. So our understanding, it will run for 3 years. The objective will be to put pressure on European states, and it's also enabled them to expand wildly across Africa. What we're not watching.
Yeah, we've talked about this in the past with Wagner.
Yeah, I mean, Wagner is just way more... Wagner's main operations aren't Ukraine. Taiwan, the moment the U.S. has more chip manufacturing, it's not a strategic concern anymore. And while we keep watching that, so the good of the media is, yes, I think we do need to get these conversations out. How do we change the narrative and of understanding about ISIS and Al-Qaeda so that we can be pragmatic in addressing these threats? Because we're living off of doctrine that's 20 years old that never worked. We've diminished our intelligence capabilities. We've diminished our understanding of these things. But then you're going to have dogmatic head talkers that just want their 2 minutes on Fox or CNN that are going to come out and haven't been on the ground. Otherwise, we're not going to deal with the problems. We're just going to be like, oh, we didn't know it happened. Get the people who were the think tank talkers out of it, because it's kind of like it's like a partisanship where they're so aligned on a topic to an agenda that it's destructive.